Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're pulling back the curtain on a true retail anomaly, a company that has likely filled your pantry and perhaps your gas tank, Costco Wholesale Corporation.
That's right, TOSIT.
Most of us know it for the incredible bulk deals and, well, that famous $1.50 hot dog.
Can't forget the hot dog.
Exactly. But have you ever stopped to wonder what truly makes Costco so incredibly successful, beyond just the low prices? Because here's the fascinating twist. It's more than just a warehouse where you buy toilet paper in industrial quantities.
Uh-huh.
What if I told you that its meticulously engineered business model, in many ways, behaves more like a tech subscription service than your average big box store?
That's a great way to put it.
We've pored over an in-depth investment analysis that unpacks this company from every single angle. Our mission for you today is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge about Costco's unique strategy, its powerful financial engine, and its fascinating future prospects. Basically, turning complex insights into clear understanding for you.
And what's fascinating here is that Costco truly defies many traditional retail norms. I mean, on the surface, it seems almost paradoxical, doesn't it?
How so?
That they manage to achieve impressive profitability with what appear to be incredibly low merchandise margins. It's a business model that simply doesn't quite make sense until you understand its core.
Right.
And that core, as we'll explore in detail, is what the analysis calls the membership flywheel. It's a self-reinforcing cycle that drives almost everything they do, creating a steady, predictable revenue stream that, frankly, few other retailers can boast about.
We often think of retail as, you know, just sales. But Costco seems to flip the script. How does their fundamental business model differ so much from every other store we walk into? I mean, when you push that cart through the aisles at Costco, it truly feels distinct.
It absolutely does. And you're right, it's fundamentally different. At its core, Costco is an international chain of membership-only warehouse clubs. Now, this isn't just some quirky feature. It's foundational to everything. Their entire model is predicated on a deceptively simple yet incredibly powerful concept. They offer a limited selection of high-quality products. It's a mix of well-known national brands and their own very robust private label items, Kirkland Signature.
Right, Kirkland.
And they offer all of these at incredibly low prices. The strategic goal here isn't to maximize profit on each individual item sold. Instead, it's all about achieving an extremely high sales volume and, crucially, rapid inventory turnover.
And how does that no-frills warehouse environment play into all of this? Because let's be honest, you're certainly not getting fancy displays or even a huge variety of different brands to choose from.
Precisely. That no-frills approach is a critical piece of their operational efficiency puzzle. It means they incur significantly lower overhead costs compared to traditional retailers.
Makes sense.
Combine that with their immense bulk purchasing power and a highly streamlined distribution system, and you get a company that can operate profitably even with gross margins that are substantially lower than what you'd see at your typical grocery store or department store. They derive their profit from sheer volume and relentless efficiency, not from high markups on individual items.
So it's a completely different game plan from the get-go.
Yeah.
But this membership model seems to be at the heart of everything they do. For listeners who might not be familiar, how does this membership flywheel actually work? Is it truly a self-reinforcing cycle, or is there, like, a catch?
That's right. The membership model is not merely a revenue stream. It's the very cornerstone of their strategy, creating this powerful self-reinforcing cycle that has almost no catch, really, beyond that initial fee you pay.
Okay, explain that.
Think of it like this. The incredibly low prices Costco offers on its merchandise are the primary incentive for you, the customer, to purchase an annual membership. You see the immediate value, right? The potential savings, and you're willing to pay that upfront fee. Now, here's the crucial part. The revenue generated from these membership fees is an incredibly stable, high-margin income stream. Unlike merchandise sales, which can fluctuate with consumer trends or economic conditions, this fee income is largely pure profit.
Pure profit? Why?
This robust, predictable fee income effectively subsidizes their merchandise operations, giving them the freedom to maintain that aggressive, market-leading pricing strategy. They don't need to make much, if anything, on the products themselves to remain profitable overall.
So it really is a virtuous circle. a loop that just keeps spinning. Can you break down the steps of how that flywheel constantly reinforces itself?
Certainly. It begins with those low prices. Those low prices validate the membership, right? They make you feel like you're getting an outstanding deal, which drives both remarkably high renewal rates for existing members and attracts a steady stream of new signups. You tell your friends, they witness the value, maybe they go with you once, and they decide to join. This naturally leads to a large, loyal, and consistently growing membership base, which in turn guarantees an incredibly high volume of sales flowing through Costco's warehouses.
Guaranteed volume.
Because there are so many people shopping there consistently and buying in bulk, Costco gains immense bargaining power with its suppliers. They can negotiate lower costs for their merchandise than almost anyone else in the industry.
Okay.
And here's where the loop truly closes. Those cost savings are then passed right back to the members in the form of even lower prices. This further strengthens the value proposition, reinforcing why the membership is indispensable, which in turn attracts even more members. It's a continuous, perpetual cycle of value creation and loyalty.
In the analysis, he even mentioned this fascinating detail about their operational efficiency. Costco often sells its inventory before even having to pay its suppliers. That creates a unique cash-generating float they can use. How does that work exactly?
Exactly. That's a testament to their incredibly high inventory turnover combined with their favorable payment terms negotiated with suppliers. What this means is that Costco is collecting cash from its customers for the goods they sell before they've actually paid their vendors for that same inventory.
That's amazing.
It creates a powerful cash float, essentially, free capital that significantly helps finance their day-to-day operations and growth initiatives, rather than needing to rely as heavily on external financing for working capital. It's a huge operational advantage that feeds right back into the flywheel by keeping their overall cost structure remarkably lean.
So it's a constant loop of value and loyalty, truly building on itself. It makes sense why this is such a unique business. When we think of retail, we primarily think of sales. But for Costco, it's a bit more nuanced than that. How do they actually make their money? Is it just through the membership fees and product sales, or is there more to it, especially considering those razor-thin margins on merchandise?
You're right to ask, because while net sales are the largest component of their revenue, the composition is key to understanding their overall profitability. In fiscal year 2024, which concluded in September of that year, Costco generated a whopping $249.6 billion in net sales. That's billion with a B.
Wow.
Marking a solid 5% increase over the prior year. This revenue came from diverse categories: foods and sundries, non-foods like electronics and apparel, and fresh foods such as produce and meat. But what's increasingly interesting is how much of that is driven by what they call ancillary businesses.
Ancillary businesses, like what exactly are we talking about?
Think about all those additional services they offer right there on site. The gasoline stations, the pharmacies, optical centers, hearing aid centers, and of course, the ever popular and strategically located food courts inside the warehouses.
Right, the food courts and the gas.
In fiscal year 2024, gasoline sales alone constituted about 12% of their total net sales, drawing in members regularly. E-commerce also plays a growing role, accounting for roughly 7% of net sales in FY 2024, showing strong growth in that channel as well.
Okay, so a huge chunk of their revenue is merchandise sales, plus these other services. But then there are the membership fees. They're smaller in absolute terms, only $4.8 billion in FY 2024, also up 5%. But the analysis says they are a critical driver of profitability. How can a smaller number be so critical?
This is where the high-margin nature of membership fees comes into play. Unlike selling a television or a gallon of milk, where they might make a very slim percentage, almost all of that membership fee revenue flows directly to the bottom line as profit.
Oh, okay.
It's recognized ratably over the one-year membership term, providing an incredibly stable and predictable income stream. This stability, this high-margin cushion, is precisely what allows them to aggressively price their merchandise.
Right.
The analysis explicitly states that membership fees consistently account for a substantial portion of the company's operating income. In fact, in fiscal 2024, those $4.8 billion in fees accounted for over 52% of the company's total operating income of $9.3 billion.
Over half their operating income from just membership fees. That's astounding.
It is. That is a massive differentiator in the retail world, effectively shielding their core profitability from the volatile merchandise market.
This raises an important question then.
Yeah.
How do they foster such incredible loyalty that people are not only willing to pay a fee, but keep coming back year after year after year?
It all comes back to their primary value proposition: consistently offering high-quality products at the lowest possible prices. This isn't just a marketing slogan, right? It's a core commitment, a promise symbolized by the iconic $1.50s hot dog and soda combo. They have famously refused to raise its price for decades, sending a clear message to members that they will prioritize unwavering value above all else, even if it means sacrificing a little bit of short-term margin. The steadfast focus cultivates an exceptionally loyal customer base, which, frankly, is the most critical asset they possess.
And the numbers really back that up, don't they? It's not just anecdotal stories about hot dogs.
Not at all. The loyalty is quantitatively demonstrated by their consistently high membership renewal rates. At the end of fiscal 2024, the renewal rate stood at an impressive 92.9% in the U.S. and Canada.
93% almost.
And 90.5% on a worldwide basis. Think about that. Over 9 out of 10 members choose to renew every single year, and their membership base continues to grow robustly. Total paid members increased from 65.8 million in fiscal 2022 to a remarkable 76.2 million in fiscal 2024.
76 million members.
And if you include all household cardholders, essentially everyone with a card tied to a membership, that number reached a staggering 136.8 million in 2024.
That's a huge number of people. And what about the executive membership? It seems like almost everyone I know has one of those now.
It's become incredibly popular, and for good reason. The executive membership offers a 2% reward on qualified purchases, effectively giving you cash back on most of your spending there, up to a certain limit. In fiscal 2024, executive members accounted for 73.3% of Costco's worldwide net sales. This indicates that their most engaged, highest spending customers are largely the ones opting for the executive tier, driving the vast majority of their business.
So it pays for itself if you spend enough.
Exactly. It's a brilliant way to incentivize even greater loyalty and spending from their most valuable customers, and it also comes with additional perks.
Beyond the membership, what else gives Costco that unique edge? That moat, as the analysis calls it, that makes it so hard for others to replicate. How do they build that kind of trust?
That would be the Kirkland Signature brand. It's a truly crucial element of their competitive advantage. Launched back in 1995, Kirkland Signature isn't just some, you know, generic store brand. It's strategically designed to offer products of a quality equal to or even greater than national brands, but at significantly lower prices.
So it's not just about being cheaper. It's about being better and cheaper. That sounds like a really powerful combination.
Exactly. This strategy serves multiple purposes for Costco. First, it profoundly differentiates their merchandise. You literally can't get Kirkland Signature products anywhere else.
True.
Second, it deeply enhances their value proposition for members. And critically, from a financial perspective, it generally yields higher profit margins for Costco compared to selling third-party branded goods, further contributing to their overall profitability.
And there's a fascinating story behind how they actually make these products, isn't there? It's not just some anonymous factory. Many people might not realize this.
No, it's a masterful use of their supplier relationships. Many Kirkland products are co-branded or even manufactured by well-known national brands, often in secret. For instance, Kirkland Signature Coffee has been produced by Starbucks and their batteries by Duracell.
Really? Starbucks and Duracell?
Yep. This creates a symbiotic relationship. The manufacturers can utilize their excess capacity and benefit from Costco's immense order volumes, while Costco gains access to high-quality products without the massive marketing and advertising costs that national brands incur. They effectively ride on the established quality and trust of the manufacturer while offering it under their own trusted private label.
The scale of that brand is just massive. The analysis mentioned that by 2021, Kirkland accounted for 31% of Costco's total revenue, generating over $59 billion in sales. I mean, that's more than the combined sales of major consumer packaged goods companies like Campbell Soup, Hershey, and Kellogg's.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that in Q3 FY2025, Kirkland sales continued to outpace overall company growth.
That's why I call it a truly significant competitive advantage. The brand's reputation for quality and value is a powerful driver of member loyalty, creating a kind of destination brand within Costco itself. People go to Costco specifically for Kirkland products, you know, which then draws them into the rest of the warehouse. It's a very smart, very effective moat that reinforces the entire membership flywheel.
Okay, so we've dissected Costco's unique internal engine. Now, let's zoom out a bit to the broader retail landscape. With such a distinct business model, how does Costco really stack up against the competition in the broader retail race? Are there rivals playing by the same rules, or is this really its own unique segment?
You're absolutely right. They're not operating in a vacuum, but it is a very unique segment. The warehouse club industry is generally considered mature and highly concentrated, effectively an oligopoly.
An oligopoly.
Right. It's dominated by three main players. Costco, of course, then Sam's Club, which is a division of Walmart, and the smaller, more regionally focused BJ's Wholesale Club.
And what's the sheer size of this market in the U.S.? It must be huge.
Oh, it's colossal. The U.S. market for warehouse clubs and supercenters was estimated at a staggering $750.4 billion in 2024 and is projected to reach $771.1 billion in 2025.
$770 billion.
While that reflects steady, moderate growth domestically, globally, the warehouse clubs market is forecast to grow at a compound annual growth rate, that's CAGR, of approximately 4.6% between 2025 and 2033. So it's a large, stable, and growing market with definite international potential.
What are the main things driving that growth, and are there any inherent limitations that could maybe slow them down a bit?
The primary growth drivers are increasing consumer demand for convenience and, crucially, cost-effectiveness, especially with, you know, more urban living and a continued focus on value. Consumers are consistently drawn to the value proposition of bulk purchasing and discounted prices.
Makes sense.
However, there is a structural restraint, that upfront membership fee. For some potential customers, it can be a barrier to entry, which naturally limits the total addressable market to those willing to pay it. But on the flip side, significant opportunities for growth still exist, mainly through international expansion into emerging markets with growing middle classes and through the continued strategic integration of e-commerce and digital services.
The pandemic really reshaped how we shop, didn't it? And for many, it changed what we value. What lasting shifts have occurred in consumer behavior that have actually played directly into Costco's strengths?
That's a great question, because the pandemic had a profound and, I think, lasting impact. One notable trend is what's called the bifurcation of spending.
Bifurcation.
Yeah. What this means is that both the budget conscious and the premium segments of consumers are thriving, while many middle market retailers are facing significant pressure. Warehouse clubs, positioned as leaders in the value segment, fit perfectly into that budget conscious demand.
So if you're not going high end, you're going for value. And Costco is right there to capture that market.
Exactly. This intensified focus on value is critical. In an environment of economic uncertainty and, well, inflation, consumers have become increasingly focused on making their money go further. In the first quarter of 2025, an estimated 75% of consumers reported trading down to more cost-effective brands for household essentials.
75%.
This trade-down effect serves as a significant tailwind for warehouse clubs, reinforcing their core value proposition and attracting new members who are actively seeking to stretch their budgets.
And despite the huge shift to online shopping, we've still seen a kind of resilience of in-person retail. How does that support Costco's physical warehouse model, especially that whole treasure hunt aspect people seem to love?
It's crucial for them. Data from the first half of 2025 showed that foot traffic to retail and dining establishments was actually higher than pre-pandemic levels.
Higher? Really?
Yes. This trend strongly supports the physical warehouse model, especially given the treasure hunt aspect of the Costco shopping experience. People love the discovery of new and unexpected items, the impulse buys, and the sheer physicality of shopping in the warehouse, which is something online simply can't fully replicate. It's an experience, not just a transaction, right? And that keeps people coming back to the physical store.
The online world is constantly evolving, though, and convenience is king. How is Costco adapting to the e-commerce wave, and what are the challenges they face in this digital realm to keep up?
Well, the primary challenge, and also an opportunity, comes from online-only retailers. They can often compete aggressively on price and offer the, let's face it, unparalleled convenience of home delivery, which certainly poses a threat to the traditional brick-and-mortar model.
Sure.
However, Costco is not ignoring this. They operate e-commerce sites in 8 countries, and while this channel is still a relatively small part of their total business, accounting for about 7% of net sales in FY 2024, it's growing rapidly. In the third quarter of fiscal 2025, they reported a very strong 14.8% growth in comparable e-commerce sales.
So they are growing online, but how do they stack up against rivals known for their digital savvy? I mean, are they perhaps lagging a bit behind?
That's a key point. Competitors like Sam's Club, leveraging Walmart's extensive digital expertise, have been noted for their innovations, such as the Scan & Go mobile app that allows shoppers to bypass checkout lines entirely.
All right, Scan & Go is pretty slick.
It is. And while Costco's unique in-store experience provides a powerful draw that is difficult to replicate online, the analysis points out that their slower adoption of a fully integrated digital experience compared to some rivals could represent a long-term risk. This is especially true as younger, digitally native generations become the core consumer demographic. They need to find a way to seamlessly merge that physical treasure hunt with robust, convenient digital options.
We've all felt the pinch of inflation over the past few years, sometimes acutely. How has this affected a company like Costco, which operates on such famously thin margins? Has it been a double-edged sword?
It really has been a significant dual impact for them. On one hand, it directly increased their merchandise costs and operating expenses like utilities and transportation, putting pressure on those already thin margins. No one is immune to higher input costs, right?
Right.
However, on the other hand, a high inflation environment actually drives more consumers to seek value, which can significantly boost traffic and sales for a company like Costco. It's truly a double-edged sword, as you said.
So people are looking for deals, and Costco is the place for deals. But how have they managed it when their own costs are rising? Do they pass it all on?
Not entirely. Their management commented in the Q3 2025 earnings call that as some commodity costs, like those for eggs and butter, began to fall, Costco was able to lower prices on those key items faster than many of its competitors.
Ah, reinforcing the value.
Exactly, reinforcing their value leadership in the minds of their members. In terms of supply chain, their immense scale and direct relationships with suppliers provide some insulation from disruptions. They even took the extraordinary step of chartering their own container ships during the peak of the supply chain crisis in 2022 and 2023 to ensure merchandise flow.
I remember that, chartering ships.
The subsequent normalization of those supply chains and stopping the chartering activities actually had a 16 basis point, meaning 0.16% positive impact on their gross margin in fiscal 2024. This demonstrates their proactive management and ability to leverage their scale even in challenging environments.
Okay, let's put Costco under the microscope now, right next to its main rivals within the warehouse club sector. How does it truly stack up against Sam's Club and BJ's Wholesale Club? Because while they all do bulk, there are clear differences that define them, aren't there?
Absolutely. The data makes it very clear. Costco is the undisputed leader in this space by a significant margin. If we look at the fiscal year 2024 total revenue, Costco generated an impressive $249.6 billion.
Almost $250 billion.
Compare that to Sam's Club, which was at $86.0 billion, and BJ's Wholesale Club at $20.5 billion.
That's a huge difference. Costco's revenue is more than double its two main competitors combined. That really puts its scale into perspective, doesn't it?
It truly does. In terms of physical footprint, as of 2025, Costco has 627 U.S. stores and over 897 global stores, making it a truly international player with a significant presence across continents.
Global reach.
Sam's Club has 599 U.S. stores and is largely U.S. focused, while BJ's is much smaller, with 266 U.S. stores and is exclusively U.S. only, concentrating mostly on the Eastern Seaboard. This translates directly to market share too, with Costco estimated to have about 62% of the U.S. warehouse club market.
62%.
Sam's Club around 31% and BJ's about 7%.
So not only are they bigger, but do they also attract a different kind of shopper, or are they all basically after the same customer?
Yes, the demographics vary slightly, which is interesting. While all three benefit from the value-driven consumer, analysis shows that Costco tends to attract visitors from higher income areas and larger households compared to Sam's Club and BJ's.
Higher income. Interesting.
This demographic might be less price sensitive when it comes to the membership fee itself and might have a greater capacity for those larger bulk purchases, which contributes to higher average transaction sizes and those very strong renewal rates we discussed.
And how do their strategies differ? What makes each of them unique beyond just their size and maybe demographics?
Each has carved out its own niche to compete. Sam's Club, for instance, aggressively leverages its parent company, Walmart's extensive digital expertise, focusing heavily on innovations like their Scan and Go app to enhance convenience and checkout speed.
Right, the tech angle.
BJ's, with its smaller footprint, tends to concentrate in the eastern U.S. and differentiates itself by putting a heavy emphasis on fresh food offerings, aiming to capture a larger share of its members' regular grocery spending.
Focus on fresh.
Costco, on the other hand, relies heavily on its Kirkland brand loyalty, the sheer breadth of its unique offerings that treasure hunt feel, and its highly valued ancillary services like travel and, especially, gasoline.
Why is Costco so incredibly hard to copy? What are its moats, those durable competitive advantages that keep rivals from simply doing what they do and taking their market share? There's be something fundamental.
There are a few very strong ones, deeply embedded in their unique business model. The first is simply their economies of scale and cost leadership. It's hard to overstate this. Their massive sales volume gives them unparalleled purchasing power. They can demand the absolute lowest possible prices from suppliers because of the sheer volume they commit to.
Huge orders.
And this is coupled with a relentless focus on cost control throughout their operations. The no-frills warehouse format, the incredibly high inventory turnover, and their efficient logistics network all combine to create a low-cost operating structure that is exceptionally difficult for any competitor to replicate at their scale.
So it's not just buying big, it's being lean and mean everywhere else too.
Exactly. And then we have to revisit the membership model, which is truly the linchpin of their entire strategy. It's not just a revenue stream, it creates an incredibly loyal, sticky customer base that is far less prone to switching retailers.
Very sticky.
And it provides a high-margin, recurring revenue stream that is largely decoupled from the daily fluctuations of merchandise sales. As we noted, in fiscal 2024, their $4.8 billion in membership fees accounted for over 52% of their $9.3 billion in operating income.
52%. Still blows my mind.
This fee income provides a substantial profit cushion, allowing Costco to price its merchandise with those razor-thin margins, creating a value proposition that non-membership retailers simply cannot match profitably on a sustained basis. It's truly their secret weapon.
What about brand loyalty? How does that factor in as a moat? Is it truly unique compared to other store brands?
That falls under brand loyalty and intangible assets. The trust and loyalty Costco has built with its members is incredibly powerful, and it's most evident in the strength of the Kirkland signature brand. As we discussed, Kirkland has become a destination brand in its own right. People trust its quality and value implicitly, and they specifically seek it out when they go to Costco.
Yeah, people rave about certain Kirkland items.
Exactly. This intangible asset of trust and brand equity is incredibly valuable and very difficult for any newcomer to build quickly or replicate.
Who else is vying for the value-conscious consumer, beyond just the other warehouse clubs? And how does Costco manage to maintain its iron grip on pricing authority in such a crowded market? It feels like everyone's trying to be cheap now.
Beyond Sam's Club and BJ's, Costco faces broader competitive threats from a wide spectrum of retailers. These include global superstores like Walmart and Target, e-commerce giants like Amazon, and hard discounters such as Aldi and Lidl.
A lot of competition.
All of these players are vying intensely for the value-conscious consumer's wallet, creating an intensely competitive retail landscape where price is often a key battleground.
So how do they keep that pricing authority, especially with so many others trying to offer low prices? Is it just that membership fee allowing them to undercut everyone?
It's primarily driven by that membership fee, yes, but also their philosophy. Costco's pricing philosophy is not about maximizing short-term profit on any single item. Instead, it's about maintaining its long-term pricing authority in the minds of its members.
Pricing authority. I like that term.
Their aim is to consistently provide the best possible value, reinforcing the idea that the membership fee is a worthwhile investment. This strategy builds immense trust and ensures that members turn to Costco first for a wide range of needs, confident they are receiving a fair price. This long-term focus, enabled directly by the inherent profitability of the membership fee, is the key element of its sustained success and market leadership. It allows them to absorb price fluctuations or temporary cost increases in a way that others simply can't afford to do.
Numbers truly paint a powerful story, especially when it comes to business success like Costco's. What does Costco's financial history reveal about its performance over, say, the last decade? Is it just growing, or is it growing smarter, more profitably?
It reveals a remarkably consistent and powerful growth engine that is indeed growing smarter. Looking at the period from fiscal 2015 to 2024, Costco's total revenue grew at a compound annual growth rate, or CAGR, of 9.1%. That's strong, steady growth.
9% a year, consistently.
But here's the more impressive part that shows they're growing smarter. Their net income grew even faster at 13.4% CAGR.
Wow, faster than revenue.
And diluted earnings per share, or EPS, grew at 13.3% CAGR. This signifies that the company isn't just growing its top line, it's also generating operating leverage.
Operating leverage meaning?
Meaning its profits are growing proportionally faster than its revenue, often because its fixed costs are being spread over a larger sales base. This shows expanding overall profitability as it scales, a clear sign of excellent and efficient management.
That's truly impressive, especially for a company of its size and maturity. But despite those famously low merchandise margins we discussed earlier, Costco's overall profitability seems surprisingly stable. How do they pull that off, given the thin line they seem to walk?
That stability is a testament to their disciplined operational control and, again, the unwavering power of those high-margin membership fees. Looking at the trailing 12 months, that's TTM ending May 2025, their gross margin percentage was 12.8%, their operating margin 3.8%, and their net margin 2.9%.
Still thin, but stable.
Exactly. These figures have remained remarkably stable over time, even amidst economic challenges like inflation. For instance, in fiscal 2024, their gross margin percentage actually saw a positive impact, driven partly by the strength of their ancillary businesses and the cessation of those expensive charter shipping activities from previous years.
Ah, stopping the ship charters helped.
It did. And while their selling, general, and administrative expenses, or SG&A, did increase slightly due to higher employee wages, these were largely offset by increased sales volume and powerful productivity gains. They managed the costs well.
So even with rising costs like wages, they're managing to keep their overall profitability strong. And what about the returns on capital? Are they efficient with the money they invest back into the business?
This is where the fundamental quality of the business really shines through. Despite having that low margin profile on merchandise, Costco consistently generates exceptionally high returns on capital. For the trailing 12 months ending May 2025, their return on equity, or ROE, was an exceptional 32.1%.
32% ROE.
And their return on invested capital, ROIC, was a strong 18.9%. These are elite indicators of a fundamentally high-quality business and highly efficient management at deploying capital to generate strong profits for shareholders.
That's great for investors, clearly. But how does all of this translate into actual cash for the company day to day? And what exactly is a negative working capital cycle, which the analysis mentions as a key part of their incredible cash generation? Sounds complex.
It sounds complex, but the concept is powerful. Costco is, simply put, a highly efficient cash-generating machine. The negative working capital cycle is a huge advantage that contributes significantly to that cash generation.
Okay, break it down.
It means that due to their incredibly high inventory turnover selling products really quickly and their favorable payment terms with suppliers, they actually collect cash from their customers for the sale of merchandise before they have to pay their vendors for that same inventory.
So they get paid first, then pay their bills later.
Essentially, yes. This creates a powerful cash flow, basically free, interest-free capital that effectively helps finance the company's operations and growth without needing to borrow heavily or tie up significant external capital in inventory or receivables.
They're essentially operating on their customers' and suppliers' money, in a way. That's incredibly efficient and seems like a massive competitive advantage.
It absolutely is. In fiscal 2023 alone, the company generated a robust $11.1 billion in cash flow from operating activities, which underscores just how effective this model is at generating liquidity and funding its own expansion.
Beyond the big financial statements, what two metrics really tell you how Costco is doing right now, like a pulse check on the underlying health of the business?
The two most critical indicators, the ones analysts watch really closely, are comparable sales growth and membership renewal rates.
Okay, comparable sales.
Comparable sales growth, also known as same-store sales, measures the year-over-year sales growth from warehouses that have been open for more than 1 year. It's a vital indicator of the underlying health and customer appeal of the business because it strips out the impact of simply opening new stores.
Got it. How are they doing there?
Pretty well. For instance, in the third quarter of fiscal 2025, Costco reported total company comparable sales growth of 5.7%, or an even more impressive 8.0% when adjusted for the impacts of gasoline price deflation and foreign currency fluctuations. That's a strong organic growth number, indicating healthy demand from existing locations.
And the membership renewal rates we talked about before, that seems like the ultimate sign of customer satisfaction, right?
Exactly. This metric is a direct reflection of customer satisfaction and loyalty. Costco's ability to consistently maintain renewal rates above 90% globally, as we've seen, underscores the stickiness of its customer base and the perceived value of its membership. Mm-hmm. When you see those consistently high renewal rates, you know members are happy and feel they're getting their money's worth, which is absolutely foundational to their profit model.
So for a company this colossal, which is already so successful and widespread, how do they keep finding avenues for growth? It feels like they're everywhere already. Mm-hmm. What's their playbook for fueling future expansion?
Well, the primary driver of Costco's long-term growth still remains the systematic opening of new warehouses. They continue to expand their physical footprint in a very disciplined manner, identifying prime locations that can support their high-volume model. Management has indicated plans to open 28 new locations in fiscal 2025.
28 new stores in 1 year.
With 25 of those being net new locations after accounting for any relocations or upgrades. So, still significant expansion.
And is that expansion mostly in the U.S., or are they looking more internationally now?
A significant portion of this expansion is targeted outside the U.S. in international markets such as Sweden, Korea, and particularly China, where the company's penetration is currently lower and the growth potential is significantly higher given the emerging middle class there.
Makes sense. Go where the growth is.
But even in more mature markets like the U.S., their strategy involves not just entering entirely new regions, but also strategically opening new warehouses near existing high-volume locations.
That sounds counterintuitive, almost like they're competing with themselves. The analysis calls it strategic cannibalization. How does that actually help them grow? Wouldn't it just split the sales?
It is counterintuitive on the surface, but it's a very calculated move. The goal is to relieve overcrowding at their busiest warehouses, which in turn significantly improves the shopping experience for members.
Better experience.
Exactly. By spreading out the customer base, lines become shorter, parking is easier, and the overall experience is just more pleasant. Ultimately, this can lead to higher overall sales for the company within that market, even if the new store draws some sales from an existing one. It's about optimizing the entire network and maximizing long-term member satisfaction, which then leads to higher overall market penetration and loyalty.
While the physical store is so central to Costco's identity, the digital space is clearly crucial for future growth, as we touched on. What are they doing specifically to modernize their e-commerce experience to keep pace with changing consumer habits? Are they catching up?
They are definitely making targeted investments here. While they continually emphasize that the in-warehouse experience will remain central to their identity, they're focused on creating a more seamless omnichannel experience.
Omnichannel, right.
Key initiatives include building capabilities for more personalized digital marketing, developing a product recommendation hub based on member browsing and purchase history, and even piloting technology to speed up in-warehouse checkout processes using mobile devices. It's all about leveraging technology to enhance, not replace, the core treasure hunt experience.
And for those big, bulky items that are honestly a pain to get home after a Costco run, like furniture or appliances.
That's where Costco Logistics comes in. They are significantly investing in this big and bulky delivery network, which often includes installation and haul-away services for old
Oh,
items.
it's handy.
This service is powering substantial growth in online sales for categories like appliances and furniture, with items delivered increasing by a remarkable 31% in the third quarter of fiscal 2025. They also recently launched a buy now, pay later option in partnership with Affirm to make big ticket purchases more accessible to members, and initial results from that have been very positive, according to management.
It's not just about what's inside the warehouse itself, is it? Their ancillary businesses, like the gas stations and pharmacies, play a surprisingly strategic role in their overall growth and appeal.
They absolutely do. These ancillary businesses are not only profitable in their own right, but they also serve as crucial traffic drivers for the warehouses. The gasoline business is a prime example.
Yeah, the lines are always long.
By consistently offering some of the lowest fuel prices in a given market, Costco effectively draws members to its locations on a very regular basis, sometimes multiple times a week, ensuring they pass by the warehouse entrance. In the third quarter of fiscal 2025, the company reported two of its all-time highest weekly gallon volumes in the U.S. after extending operating hours and further investing in price competitiveness.
Wow.
Other services, such as the pharmacy, optical centers, and travel services, all add layers of value to the membership, increasing its utility and overall stickiness. They give members more reasons to use their membership and thus more reasons to renew it year after year.
This is one of their most powerful profit levers, it seems, and it directly relates back to that membership fee. What's the strategy around their membership fee pricing power, and how do they know when to pull that lever? It feels like they haven't raised it much over the years.
This is a beautiful illustration of their unique pricing power, largely enabled by their unwavering value proposition and consistently high renewal rates. Costco has demonstrated a significant ability to periodically increase its membership fees without negatively impacting that crucial member loyalty.
Okay, so they can raise it. When was the last time?
The most recent fee increase took effect on September 1st, 2024. The annual fee for Gold Star and Business memberships in the U.S. and Canada was raised by $5, from $60 to $65.
It's $5.
And the executive membership fee increased by $10, from $120 to $130.
Okay, so a relatively small increase per member, but I imagine that adds up to a huge financial impact across so many millions of members.
Exactly. This single action is expected to increase the company's high-margin revenue by approximately $370 million over the subsequent 2 years as memberships come up for renewal.
$370 million from just a $5 or $10 increase.
That's the power of their scale and loyal base. Management has historically been very patient with these increases, ensuring that the value proposition remains strong enough to support a price hike without negatively impacting renewal rates. They often describe the decision to raise fees as a question of when, not if, signaling that this will continue to be a reliable and powerful tool for future earnings growth. It's a predictable lever that very few other retailers possess, acting as a direct path to higher profitability.
So where does all that incredible cash flow actually go? How does Costco decide where to reinvest it, and how do they manage their overall financial resources? Do they just pile up the cash?
No, they're quite strategic about it. Costco's management has a long-standing reputation for a disciplined and, frankly, shareholder-friendly approach to capital allocation. Their primary use of capital is to reinvest deeply back into the business to drive long-term growth while also consistently returning excess cash to shareholders.
Okay, so reinvestment first. Where does that go?
The largest portion of their capital expenditures, or CapEx, that's money spent on acquiring or upgrading physical assets, goes into building new warehouses globally. That's still the main growth engine.
Right, the store openings.
They also make significant investments to enhance their supply chain, including optimizing their depot network and building out the Costco logistics network to support the growth of their e-commerce business, particularly for those large items we talked about.
Logistics, yeah.
And finally, capital is also allocated to remodeling existing warehouses and investing in technology to improve operational efficiency and the member experience. For fiscal year 2025, management has guided for total CapEx to be slightly over $5 billion.
$5 billion in CapEx, that's a lot of investment.
It is. They're serious about reinvesting.
Costco is also known for its unique way of returning cash to shareholders. Can you explain their dividend policy? Especially those seemingly random, very large, special dividends that pop up every few years?
It is quite unique and exciting for shareholders when it happens. Their dividend policy consists of two distinct components: a regular quarterly dividend and periodic, large, special cash dividends.
Okay, regular first.
For the regular dividend, Costco has a strong track record, having increased this dividend for 20 consecutive years, demonstrating a commitment to consistent returns. On July 16th, 2025, the board declared a quarterly dividend of $1.30 per share.
20 years of increases. Nice.
But what truly sets them apart are the special dividends. These are large, infrequent payments made when excess cash accumulates significantly on their balance sheet beyond their immediate investment needs.
So when they just have too much cash lying around.
Essentially, yes. They've paid five such dividends. $7 per share in 2012, $5 in 2015, $7 again in 2017, $10 in 2020, and most recently, a substantial $15 per share in January 2024.
$15 a share. Wow.
These special dividends represent a very significant return of capital to shareholders, though their timing is not predictable, as they depend on the accumulation of that excess cash.
And beyond dividends, do they also buy back their own stock? Or is that less of a focus for them compared to reinvesting in dividends?
Yes, share repurchases are another way they return capital to shareholders, though their approach has historically been opportunistic rather than a systematic, continuous buyback program like some other companies run.
Opportunistic meaning?
Meaning they tend to buy back shares when they see an attractive valuation or have excess cash beyond dividends and CapEx, rather than committing to a fixed amount each quarter. In January 2023, their board authorized a new $4 billion common stock repurchase program, which is set to expire in January 2027.
$4 billion authorized. Have they used much of it?
The actual pace of repurchases has been fairly modest in recent years. For instance, in fiscal 2024, they repurchased $700 million of their stock, following $676 million in fiscal 2023 and $439 million in fiscal 2022. So while the authorization is there, they've been more conservative in their actual execution of buybacks compared to some other big companies. Dividends, especially special ones, seem to be the preferred way to return large chunks of cash.
How strong is their financial bedrock overall? Is their balance sheet truly a fortress, as the analysis suggests, or is there maybe more debt hidden away than meets the eye?
No, their balance sheet is absolutely a fortress. Costco maintains a very conservative financial profile, which contributes significantly to its stability and resilience.
How conservative?
As of May 11, 2025, the company held a substantial $13.8 billion in cash and cash equivalents, along with $1.0 billion in short-term investments. Against that, their total long-term debt was only $5.7 billion.
So way more cash than debt.
Exactly. This results in a significant net cash position, meaning they have far more cash and liquid investments than total debt. Their debt-to-equity ratio is very low, standing at 0.31 as of August 2025, which indicates minimal reliance on borrowed money and, crucially, significant financial flexibility. This strong financial position allows the company to comfortably fund its growth initiative, pay those special dividends when appropriate, and weather economic downturns without any significant financial strain. It's a very safe balance sheet.
Okay, even a company as strong and well-managed as Costco isn't completely immune to external pressures, right?
Right.
What challenges has it faced over the past couple of years in this pretty dynamic economic landscape?
Indeed. No company is immune. Over the past 24 months or so, Costco, much like the broader retail industry, has had to navigate a complex macroeconomic environment. The primary headwinds have stemmed from persistent inflation, global supply chain disruptions, rising labor costs, and the fluctuations of foreign currency exchange rates.
Let's start with inflation. How has that specifically impacted their operations and those famously thin merchandise margins that are so core to their whole model? Did it squeeze them hard?
Inflation has presented that dual challenge we talked about earlier. On one hand, it directly increased their cost of goods sold, naturally putting pressure on those already thin merchandise margins. You can't avoid input costs rising.
Right.
On the other, it has also increased their operating expenses, particularly in areas like utilities and transportation, where costs have soared for everyone. While Costco's immense scale and purchasing power provide some mitigation against these pressures, they are not entirely immune. Management has had to make strategic decisions about whether to absorb these higher costs or pass them on to members, constantly balancing profitability with their unwavering commitment to maintaining their pricing authority.
And from the consumer side?
Well, from the consumer's perspective, while inflation drives value-seeking behavior that often benefits Costco, it also erodes household purchasing power, potentially impacting sales of higher ticket discretionary items, things you don't absolutely need.
And supply chain issues have plagued so many industries in recent years. How did Costco navigate those incredibly choppy waters, especially given their reliance on global sourcing for so many products?
They faced ongoing challenges from the pandemic-era disruptions, absolutely. This led to increased shipping costs and longer lead times for products coming from overseas, especially Asia. To ensure a steady flow of merchandise for their members, Costco took that extraordinary step we mentioned of chartering its own container ships between 2022 and 2023.
Which must have been expensive.
Extremely expensive, but it was a direct and necessary response to the global logistics crunch at the time. The subsequent normalization of those supply chains and the discontinuation of these expensive chartering activities actually had that significant positive impact we noted earlier, providing a 16 basis point boost to their gross margin in fiscal 2024. But managing inventory in that environment was incredibly complex, requiring a careful balance between ensuring product availability and avoiding excess stock that could lead to costly markdowns.
Costco is well known for treating its employees well, often paying competitive wages and benefits. But what's the financial cost of that philosophy in an environment of broad wage inflation like we've seen recently?
It's a key point and part of their core philosophy. Their belief is that competitive wages and benefits drive high productivity and low employee turnover, which they view as a powerful long-term strategic advantage that creates a more stable, efficient workforce.
Less churn, better workers.
Exactly. However, in a tight labor market characterized by significant wage inflation across industries, the company has implemented several wage increases to remain a competitive employer and attract talent. While consistent with their long-term strategy, these actions have directly increased their selling, general, and administrative expenses, or SG&A.
So hit the bottom line.
Yes. Management commentary from earnings calls in late 2024 and early 2025 explicitly cited higher employee wages as a headwind to SG&A as a percentage of sales, showing a direct impact on their operational costs, even if they believe it's the right long-term move.
And as a massive global company, they must also grapple with currency fluctuations. How have those currency headwinds affected their international operations and overall reported numbers, especially with a strong dollar?
Absolutely. With significant operations in Canada, Mexico, Japan, the UK, and other international markets, Costco's reported financial results are naturally subject to the effects of foreign currency translation. Over the past couple of years, a relatively strong US dollar has created a noticeable headwind.
How does that work again?
It means that revenues and profits generated in foreign currencies, when converted back into U.S. dollars for reporting purposes, translate into fewer U.S. dollars. For fiscal year 2024, changes in foreign currency rates had an estimated negative impact of $474 million on net sales alone.
Almost half a billion dollars just from currency.
Just from the translation effect, yes. This effect was also noted as a drag on comparable sales results in the first and second quarters of fiscal 2025, demonstrating how global economics can directly impact their reported numbers, even when the underlying business in local currency is performing strongly.
Okay, so we've covered the bumps in the road they've already navigated. But despite Costco's strong track record and formidable competitive advantages, what potential pitfalls or key risks and concerns should we, as curious observers, be aware of looking out into the future?
No company's perfect, Rick. That's a crucial part of any deep dive, looking at the risks. First, let's consider the impact of a potential economic recession. While Costco's value proposition often allows it to perform relatively well during economic slowdowns, as consumers trade down from more expensive retailers, a severe or prolonged recession could still negatively impact its business.
How so, if people are looking for value?
A significant rise in unemployment and a sharp contraction in overall consumer spending could lead to reduced spending on big-ticket, discretionary items, think TVs, furniture, jewelry, which are an important part of Costco's merchandise mix and often carry better margins.
The non-essentials.
Exactly. And crucially, financially strained households might choose not to renew their memberships to save on the annual fee, which would directly impact the company's most profitable and stable revenue stream. That's the biggest recession risk for them.
That would certainly be a significant hit to their core strength.
Mm-hmm.
What about margin pressure, given how thin those merchandise margins already are? Is there a risk they get squeezed too much?
Indeed. Their business model is built on extremely thin merchandise margins, making its profitability highly sensitive to both competitive pressures and cost inflation. Intense price competition from rivals like Sam's Club, Walmart, or Amazon could force Costco to lower its prices even further, compressing those already razor-thin margins.
A price war scenario.
Potentially. Similarly, a sustained period of high inflation in merchandise costs, labor, or freight that cannot be fully passed on to consumers could significantly erode profitability. While the membership fee provides a buffer, any significant deterioration in merchandise gross margin would be a real concern for their overall financial health. It's a constant balancing act.
Growth relies heavily on opening new warehouses, but finding suitable space isn't always easy, especially in a mature market like the U.S. What are the risks associated with real estate and expansion going forward?
You're right. It's not as simple as just deciding to open a store. As the U.S. market becomes more saturated, finding suitable and economically viable real estate sites for their massive, large-format stores is becoming increasingly difficult and expensive.
Good locations are hard to find.
Very. New store openings in existing markets also carry the inherent risk of cannibalization, where a new store's sales come partly at the expense of a nearby existing one. While Costco has a strategy for strategic cannibalization to improve overall market sales, it's still a risk that needs careful management to ensure it actually grows the total pie.
And internationally.
Furthermore, international expansion, while a key growth driver, presents its own set of risks, including navigating vastly different regulatory environments, understanding nuanced consumer preferences and new cultures, and managing complex global supply chain logistics specific to those regions. We've talked so much about the membership fee model being their biggest strength and the key to their profitability. But could it also be an Achilles heel, a point of significant vulnerability if something goes wrong? It absolutely could be. The membership fee is the lifeblood of Costco's profitability, making their dependency on it a key risk. Any event that could significantly tarnish the Costco brand or damage member trust. Think about a major data breach, a widespread product safety issue with a Kirkland product, or even just a perceived decline in the overall value of the membership that undermines the bang for your buck promise could lead to a noticeable drop in renewal rates.
And that would hurt badly.
Because those membership fees flow to the bottom line at such a very high margin, even a relatively small decline in the renewal rate could have a disproportionately large negative impact on the company's operating income. It's their powerful differentiator, but also potentially their most vulnerable point if that fundamental trust or perceived value ever erodes significantly.
And finally, a major company like Costco is undergoing significant leadership changes at the very top. What are the risks associated with the recent CEO and CFO transition, especially after such long tenures for the predecessors? Is there an execution risk?
This is definitely a point of scrutiny for the market, anytime you have changes at that level. Longtime CEO Craig Jelinek retired at the beginning of 2024, succeeded by Ron Vacris, a 40-year company veteran who famously started as a forklift driver and worked his way up through operations.
The insider.
Right. Additionally, Richard Galanti, who served as CFO for nearly four decades and was a widely respected voice with the investment community, retired in early 2025. He was succeeded by Gary Millerchip, hired externally from Kroger.
An outsider.
While the new leadership team consists of experienced insiders like Vacris and seasoned external executives like Millerchip, any major transition at the very top introduces a degree of uncertainty regarding strategic vision and execution. The performance of the new CEO and CFO will be under close scrutiny as they guide the company forward and potentially evolve its strategies, even subtly. The market will be particularly watching Millerchip's communication style and integration.
So who exactly is steering this massive ship now that we've had these significant transitions? What does their background tell us about their leadership quality and the likely future direction? Let's talk about Ron Vacris first.
The leadership team is indeed undergoing a pivotal transition, but with a strong emphasis, it seems, on continuity, especially with the CEO pick. Ron Vacris took over as CEO on January 1st, 2024. As mentioned, he's a true Costco stalwart, having been with the company for over 40 years.
40 years is incredible loyalty.
It really is. He started his career as a forklift driver and worked his way up through numerous operational roles, including Senior Vice President of Merchandising and then President and COO before becoming CEO. This deep, hands-on, ground-up experience provides him with an intimate understanding of the company's culture and unique business model that you probably couldn't get any other way.
So he knows it inside out.
Precisely. The promotion of such a long-term insider signals a commitment to strategic continuity and likely a reduction of risk in veering away from the core principles that have driven Costco's success for decades.
And the new CFO, Gary Millerchip, is a big change, given how long Richard Galanti was there and how well-known he was. What does Millerchip bring to the table?
Absolutely. The CFO role saw a more significant shift with Richard Galanti, who was essentially the public face of Costco's financials for nearly four decades, retiring in February 2025. He was succeeded by Gary Millerchip, who was hired from the Kroger Company, another massive retailer, where he also served as CFO.
So experienced, but from a different company culture.
Right. While Mr. Millerchip brings extensive retail and financial experience from another large, complex retailer to the table, the market will certainly be closely watching his integration into Costco's unique culture and, importantly, his communication style with the investment community. It's a crucial role in public-facing financial discussions and shaping investor perception, especially following someone like Galanti.
Beyond the individuals at the very top, what about the overall corporate governance practices? How transparent and stable are they generally? Is it a well-run ship from a governance perspective?
Costco's governance structure, as outlined in their annual proxy statements, appears pretty robust and generally aligned with best practices for a company of its size. For their 2025 annual meeting, the board nominated nine individuals for election as directors.
A nine-person board.
This board comprises individuals with diverse backgrounds in technology, retail, finance, and public service, with Hamilton E. James serving as chairman. In terms of shareholder rights, the company holds annual elections for all directors, ensuring accountability, and shareholders regularly vote on key items like the ratification of independent auditors and executive compensation, often referred to as say on pay.
Standard stuff, good.
The company also maintains a high level of transparency through its regular SEC filings, quarterly earnings reports, and conference calls. The leadership team, historically under Galanti and Jelinek, provided detailed insights into the company's performance, strategy, and the broader retail environment. Hopefully that continues. This overall governance framework, combined with the long-term stability of the management team and board, despite the recent top-level transitions, suggests a strong emphasis on preserving the corporate culture that is so central to Costco's identity and success.
Okay, so for all of its strengths, its unique model, its incredible flywheel, and its strong performance, what does the market actually think of Costco's value right now? I mean, how expensive is the stock? Is it trading at a premium compared to what one might expect from a traditional retailer? Feels like it must be.
It's definitely trading at a significant premium, yes, both to its retail peers and the broader market, and importantly, to its own historical levels. When you look at its current trading multiples compared to its historical ranges, there's been a clear and sustained expansion.
Like the PE ratio.
Exactly. For example, as of August 2025, Costco's trailing 12-month, that's TTM, price to earnings, or PE ratio, stands at approximately 55.0x.
55 times earnings. That's high for retail.
It is very high for retail, and it's substantially higher than its 10-year historical average PE of around 37.0x. This multiple has trended consistently upward, indicating that the market is willing to pay significantly more for each dollar of Costco's earnings than it used to.
So the market is willing to pay a lot more for each dollar of Costco's earnings than it has historically. What about other common valuation metrics? Do they tell the same story?
Yes, the same trend holds true across other key metrics. Its last 12-month or LTM enterprise value to EBITDA ratio, which looks at the company's overall value relative to its operating profit before non-cash expenses, is approximately 34.7x. This is a significant premium to its 5-year average of 25.9x.
Also much higher.
And its TTM price to sales, or PS ratio, is about 1.6x, which has more than doubled from the 0.5x-0.8x range where it traded for much of the previous decade. This across-the-board expansion valuation multiples clearly shows that the market is willing to pay significantly more for each dollar of Costco sales, earnings, and operating cash flow than it has in the past.
When you compare it to its peers, this premium becomes even clearer, doesn't it? It seems to stand completely apart from other large retailers like Walmart or Target. Why such a high premium? Is it truly that subscription effect we talked about earlier paying off in the valuation?
It absolutely does stand apart starkly. When you compare Costco to its direct competitors and other large-scale retailers like Walmart, BJ's, and Target, the valuation is consistently orders of magnitude higher on nearly every metric.
Orders of magnitude.
While Costco's PE is around 55.0x, Walmart is about 43.0x, which is also high but lower. BJ's is around 25.0x, and Target is way down at only 11.3x. Similar disparities exist for other multiples like EBITDA and price to sales.
So why? Why the huge difference?
This persistent premium strongly suggests that the market views Costco not just as another retailer, but as a fundamentally higher quality business with far more predictable and durable earnings power than its peers. And that translates directly into a higher willingness to pay for its stock. The primary justification, and really the key takeaway from our discussion today, is indeed the nature of its membership fee revenue.
Back to the fees.
This stream of income, as we've highlighted, accounts for over half of the company's operating profit, and it is uniquely highly predictable and recurring. With renewal rates consistently exceeding 90%, it's almost an annuity-like cash flow stream.
Like getting a guaranteed check every year from millions of people.
Pretty much. The market values the stability and predictability far more highly than it values the more cyclical and lower margin profits from traditional merchandise sales. In this respect, Costco's business model has characteristics remarkably similar to a subscription-based service, like a software as a service or SaaS company.
Right, like Netflix or Adobe.
Exactly. Those types of companies typically command much higher valuation multiples than traditional retailers precisely because of their recurring high-margin revenue. The subscription component, layered on top of a massive and highly efficient retail operation, is the core reason for its significant valuation premium over peers like Walmart and Target, which lack this powerful recurring revenue engine.
And does their substantial real estate portfolio factor into their valuation at all? Is there maybe some hidden value there that the market might not be fully appreciating, or is it all about the subscription fees?
It does factor in, but it's generally not considered the primary driver of their high market price, which is much more focused on that recurring revenue stream and growth outlook. Costco owns a substantial portfolio of real estate, encompassing many of its warehouses and distribution centers. As of May 2025, the company reported net property, plant, and equipment on its balance sheet of $30.6 billion.
$30 billion in property.
It is widely assumed that the book value of these assets significantly understates their current market value, as many of these properties were acquired years or even decades ago in prime locations that have appreciated significantly. So this valuable real estate portfolio certainly provides a degree of tangible asset backing to the company's valuation, acting as a solid foundation beneath its operational success, even if it's not the main reason for the high multiple.
What about their free cash flow yield and dividend yield? They appear quite low, especially given how much cash they generate. That misleading somehow?
You're right. They do appear low at first glance if you just look at the standard metrics. Based on trailing 12-month data, the company's free cash flow, FCF yield, which measures the cash generated per dollar of market value, is approximately 1.70%. Pretty low.
And the regular dividend.
The forward dividend yield on their regular quarterly dividend is about 0.53%. Also seems very low for a stable company. However, this regular dividend yield doesn't tell the whole story because it does not account for the company's history of paying those large, infrequent special dividends we discussed.
Ah, the specials again.
Those have significantly increased the total cash return to shareholders over time. When you factor those in, the picture of total cash return is much different and significantly higher than the regular dividend yield alone suggests. So, yes, the headline yield can be a bit misleading. So, what's it really worth? This is where it gets complex, I imagine, given all these factors and the high expectations baked into the price. Is it overvalued now? It absolutely does get complex, and this is where the debate lies among analysts and investors. Discounted cash flow, or DCF, models, which attempt to estimate a company's intrinsic value based on its future cash flows, produce a very wide range of outcomes for
A
Costco.
wide range, like how wide?
Well, the analysis mentions one DCF using a fairly standard 10% discount rate and 3% terminal growth rate, which suggested a value around $249 per share, way below where it's trading, implying significant overvaluation.
Okay, that's low.
But another model using a lower discount rate based on its lower cost of equity estimated a value around $904 per share, suggesting it was trading much closer to intrinsic value at the time of the analysis. And a third external source estimated it around $676, implying it was overvalued, but less dramatically.
So the models are all over the place.
Exactly. The wide dispersion in DCF outcomes underscores the central debate surrounding Costco's stock. The current market price clearly embeds expectations for strong, consistent growth for many years into the future. An assessment of whether the stock is fairly valued, overvalued, or undervalued depends heavily on your confidence in the company's ability to consistently meet or even exceed these high market expectations over the long term, leveraging that powerful membership flywheel and continuing its expansion. It's priced for near perfection, you could say. #outro go.
Wow, what an incredible deep dive into the Costco phenomenon. We've unpacked so much today, from the foundational power of its membership flywheel and the real strength of its Kirkland signature brand, to its remarkable financial stability and its unique, almost unreplicable position in the retail landscape. It's really clear how that membership model truly transforms a traditional retailer into something much more akin to a subscription service, justifying, or at least explaining, its premium valuation in the market. Hopefully, you now have a much clearer picture of what makes Costco such a unique and resilient company, defying so many of the traditional rules of retail.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Costco's story really highlights the profound power of a deeply understood customer value proposition and a business model that constantly reinforces itself. Their success isn't just about selling cheap goods, right? It's about building this self-sustaining ecosystem of value and loyalty that very few companies have managed to replicate so effectively.
A true ecosystem.
Which raises an important question, I think, for you, the listener. In a world of increasing information and changing consumer habits, where else might a membership-like model or a strong flywheel effect be hiding? Maybe in plain sight, creating overlooked value that the market might not yet fully appreciate. Perhaps even in industries you wouldn't normally expect to see it. Something to think about.
A fantastic thought to leave us with. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Costco. We hope you reflect on these insights the next time you push that oversized cart through the aisles, perhaps observing your next shopping trip with entirely new eyes. We look forward to our next deep dive with you.